packet pushers.
Hello and welcome to the Network Automation Nerds Podcast, where we explore the latest in network automation from a practitioner's perspective. I'm your host, Eric Cho, a network engineer who just loves everything about network automation. Today, we're in for a real treat as we chat with someone who's not just a leader in the community, but a true multi-talented individual, Christian Adell. Christian wears many hats and wears them with remarkable flair, I would say, from steering the ship as a leader at Network2Co to planning some of the seriously impressive sports events. He's also deeply involved in the community, quite frankly, organizing a bunch of meetups that bring people together to learn, to share, and to grow. And I would say Christian is a master at blending his passion with his work as well, as we'll chat a little bit more about that. So let's grab a coffee, settle in, and let's dive into this delightful conversation with Christian. Christian, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Eric, for having me again.
This is not your first rodeo on the Network Automation Nerds. In fact, is this your third or fourth?
I think so.
Yeah, but previously you came as a co-author for multiple books, right? So Network Observability, and you were also a co-author for the Network Programmability and Automation book, and a co-author for Network Automation with Nautilbot. So I don't know how you find the time to do all these books, man.
It's not always easy to get time for everything, but when you like something like technology and especially sharing and learning, because as you know, because you already did that, when you write a book, you are sharing knowledge, but you're also getting deep into the topics that you want to explain. So nothing better than having to get others on top of a topic that motivation to get deep for you and be ready to explain at the level that is required. So sometimes to explain in the proper way, even if it's a high level, you have to understand the nuances of every topic. So for me, it's always a challenge and an adventure just to get into these kind of projects.
Yeah, I would agree. There's a saying that teaching is the best learning tool or something of like, I'm paraphrasing, right? But definitely that whenever I think I know a subject, try teaching it to somebody else. And then you'll find all kinds of holes and you're like, oh, you know what? I'm not really understanding that little nuance. So I better go research so I don't look like a fool. And even if you know a subject to do it, it's another whole different skill to try to explain to somebody else. What do you think of that?
Totally agree. I mean, I have been sharing knowledge from the university when I end my studies, I'm going to say 20 years ago. One of my first collaborations at the university was just teaching others. I remember CCNA labs, CCNMP, and that made myself ready to go into the technology in a way that I was able to anticipate the questions for everyone in the training. And as I said before, it's kind of bringing some extra pressure, but this motivation that you need to go the extra mile.
I'm kind of curious. I could kind of tell, like, just from talking to multiple guests and obviously Cisco certs, it's a major thing, you know, coming into the field. So just from talking to different guests, I can kind of gauge like their studying time frame and even their career age, if you will, what kind of lab they use, right? So for me, it was Dynamib and Dynagen. And if I talk to people who were even earlier, they were actually, you know, buying physical boxes off eBay to like, you know, wire them. So what did you use to study the NAs and NPs?
What I can remember right now, because as I said, this was a long time ago, it was very fun and nice because I was able to do all these trainings as an extra subject at the university. So not an external training. It was included on the program. Maybe it was the first program like this in Spain where I was living. And I remember that the technologies, we were even talking about frame relay at that point.
Yes. For me as well.
Yeah, it's a long time ago, yeah. But we were talking about the campus technologies, a bit of, yeah, I don't remember exactly because I was not exposed too much to that topic later, but it was fun. It's always a learning experience.
Yeah, like mapping the DELCs and, you know, for people who only deal with IP, first, you know, congratulations because you're young and beautiful. But for those of us that are a little bit older that have to deal with ATMs, where ATM doesn't mean you're, you know, withdraw money from a machine, it's actually, you know, asynchronous.
I remember ATM.
Yeah. So frame relay. So you brought up a good point. You mentioned Spain, you know, and just judging from, you know, our conversation, you're not from the US, right? So how did you get into technology and how did you get into network engineering in particular?
from early ages, I have been always a very curious person, very curious and passionate person. So when I was ending my high school, I was thinking about what to do next. I had no clear idea of, I had no a vocation of, I would like to do that. So what I asked for, I need to do something that was technical, not super abstract, so not maths or something like that, or physics, and something that was soft, because I have never been very good at handworking. So not electronics or something like that. So I moved into telecommunication, computer science, and I drive all my career on that segment. So network engineering gave me the opportunity to balance some protocols, some standardization that I like to study how the things were organized following some plan, plus the capacity to manage and to influence from the software development part of it.
That's interesting. So even at an early age that you kind of know, right? You kind of know what you like and don't like. So you have this broad umbrella of technology that you want to do, but you know it's maybe not mechanical engineering, or maybe it's not something that you have to test the circuits or something like that. But you also know you want to deal with software. So how did you decide not to go into, like, say, software development or something that is purely coding?
Yeah, because at that point, and I still remember my first classes at the university with coding, and I was not really good because maybe of that level of abstraction. I was not ready for that at that moment. And this has been something that has shaped my career at the beginning. So I moved into network engineering because it was, as I said, a good balance between programmability and abstraction, but not as open like software development. And I was doing network engineering for a while, like a network architect. I work here in Catalonia on the regional broadcaster for a long time, I'll say more than 10 years. But I was actually starting to study with my PhD. And at that point, aside of noticing that with my family duties, my daughter, the job, studies, it was impossible to put together, I got like a trigger that made me move towards software development centric approach. In that PhD, when I was trying to simulate the networks, I found myself not capable of going hands-on software development and said, that's not possible. I came to the conclusion that I will not be able to develop that skills on my traditional network architecture role. So 2015, I took the decision, I have to change industry, I have to change my career. And I moved totally from traditional network engineering to a pure software development, DevOps approach, cloud first, completely different industry.
So a completely different approach, but were you still in the same industry with the same company or by that time? So let's go back to college, right? So you say you're at the university, you were teaching CCNA. So I presume you were already in the network engineering field. And you mentioned when you get out of the university, you started working, right? So let's take a step back and start from there to the 2015 era where you decided to take a different approach.
Actually, to be honest, I was doing in parallel. I was teaching at the university on my side time, as you know, I am doing always many things at the same time. My main role was in the regional broadcaster here in Catalonia. I was working as a, I want to say, traditional network architect in a campus, data center, internet access connectivity, but not service provider, not global internet content delivery. So it was mostly focused on what a regional broadcaster is about. So
I'm just kind of curious because I never talked to anybody in that environment. So how big is the network or what was the network like in that structure?
So I'm going to tell you just one word and you are going to start thinking about the point.
Okay.
Multicast. I still remember learning. I started with DBRMP or something like that. Then I moved into PIM, PIM, and many of different technologies because at that moment, it was the transition from the traditional video technologies that were pure video into start using IP. IP for video content edition in the internal local network. Actually, that was the project that I started with. And at the end of that was more moving into the video content delivery from different places on the different cities, different cameras. It was just bringing, converging all the media content into IP. When I left, actually, one of my last projects was changing the actual, let's say, intra-studio media delivery. That there was a big transition. I remember still the standards from organisms called SMTP that were moving all the traditional video without compression into IP. That this means like big throughput of more than 1 gigabit per second. So it was like moving from the beginning, not traditional, but a video edition in your laptop or in your computer, into the actual studios where the live media is actually merged and creating the actual program.
Yeah, I remember that era very clearly because it was a very chaotic time, as with any time when a new technology takes place. I remember even the format. I mean, people can't appreciate the fact that you have a standardized MP3 and MP4 format, right? Like back then, it was like Real Network, or there's like .wav, and there's like Microsoft had their own standard. So essentially, if you kind of locked into one format or one standard, you do your encoding, do your multiplexing, and you send it off, you kind of locked in. So it's almost like the beta versus, you know, other video formats. So back then it was pretty chaotic. And I too was dealing with multicast quite a bit, although we ditched that pretty soon because I was working for a cable company. So we were not dealing with, you know, like the creation of the files, but we were dealing with the transformation, multicasting, and the division multiplexing.
Yeah, to me, I remember that it was tough, especially to combine the requirements of the video edition that was zero loss with the nature of Ethernet that was not zero loss oriented. So
right.
Whatever there was a frozen or a freeze on the video content reproduction, there was always claiming concerns, issues. It was tough, but that was also interesting to organize that network in a way that you can minimize the problems and make it production ready. But that's far away from my memory today.
Yeah, that actually brought back a lot of memories. Now I even think back on some of the live events, right? Like today, if you remember, you know, like Netflix just did the first boxing match with Mike Tyson. And now that actually brings me back to previously when we were doing live events, that was the most nervous part for us because, you know, first of all, we don't have the time to buffer because it's a semi-live event. And if you digitize it, that means you're transporting it simultaneously. And like you said, you know, sometimes you could leverage the CDN with edge caching and so on. But for live event, that's super tough, especially back then. There's not a lot of, you know, the Akamai's or Limelight's of the world where you could, you know, leverage their network or they cause an arm and a leg. So we're basically just distributing it off our head end into each other edge nodes and just hoping, like crossing our fingers that things would still work. And that was good times. So interesting that, you know, you work in that environment. You were in the early days of doing the encoding, decoding, transporting. Then what happened in 2015? You just kind of enlightened on this new approach?
Yeah, as I said, I was in 2015 working on my PhD. I realized that, yeah, I had to do some change on my life because I have been always looking, and I still look for this feeling of exponential learning. So it's driving my life that I need to find challenges that within my possibilities. I always try to go within my boundaries, but always outside of my comfort zone. At that point, I was lucky to get the opportunity to join a tech company, a Scandinavian tech company that was landing here in Barcelona, that was creating a tech hub for, I would say it was a multinational company with more than presence in 30, 40 countries. And they were creating the main technological hub here in Barcelona and London. In Barcelona, they just brought top people, I'm going to say, from the local companies. And I was also lucky to get into that team. But I was not coming with this background of software development. I'm really glad that they trust myself and gave me the opportunity to transform myself from a traditional network engineer to, I'm going to say, a decent DevOps software developer in 1 year. So that was a big change on my life. I was serving different projects that were pure cloud-based, using all these cool things like production engineering that today is usual, a common thing. We were doing that maybe 8-9 years ago, and everything was following a continuous integration, continuous deployment approach. It was really cool for me. However, what I have seen later is that I got into so high standards that all the companies that I went after, they were always below those standards. It was not so easy to get, especially because I moved back, as you can imagine, into the networking industry where software engineering is not so built in.
Let's stop for a moment because you mentioned something that's really interesting, that you saw how DevOps was used in software development, right? So it wasn't used in network engineering. So were you kind of split brain at the time where in one aspect you were doing DevOps and having these instant gratification on, you know, from pushing code to seeing in production? And then you come back to Earth in the same company when you're dealing with network engineering, you log into CLI and do that. Or was that company so advanced that they kind of bleed that approach toward network engineering as well, as much as they can?
That's an interesting question because that company was big enough that all the traditional network engineering was a different department. I was not part of the network engineering.
Yeah.
I was part of this product and tech that was about building cloud experience for developers, just to build solutions in a cloud. I was working on different projects, but at some point, as you can imagine, because I was coming from my networking background, I was put into some initiatives in order to make this networking experience better. At that time, maybe you are familiar with, we had in AWS, there was no transit gateway at all. They were starting to get peerings just to connect VPCs. So our developers, people that didn't know and didn't care about networking, they would like to connect their products directly in order to share a database or whatever. So what we built at that point was 2017, I think, with other colleagues, was an abstraction layer that was giving them an API approach in order to say, I want to connect this service, very abstract, to another service, very abstract. And because we were tracking all the data related to these things, we were managing all the backend APIs validation in order to connect the two VPCs, establishing a VPC peering. So there was no dark magic at all, but from the developer experience, and someone told me a few years ago that they were still using that maybe 8 years after. It was like an easy way for them to say, I have this service called ABC and I will connect to service XYZ. I don't care in which region they are, what network they are using. Hopefully there is not overlap. So let's connect these things. And all the magic happened behind the scenes. Actually, this was the project that brought me into the next one, because I was presenting this project in a DevOps conference, actually. And what will become by boss, Andre Tong, that was working for Cisco at the time, he contacted me via Twitter because he saw that conference and said, oh, that could be an interesting fit for the project that they were working on.
So is Cisco where you move next?
I moved to Cisco, but more in concrete to the recently acquired OpenDNS section.
Okay.
And became Cisco umbrella.
Got it. So that's kind of interesting, because that's the experience that a lot of people had, myself included, is that the developers are so used to the cloud and this instant, you know, spinning up of a peering session or the infrastructure as code, if you will, right? Like, I don't know if that term existed back then, but certainly is true now that they're so used to having this thing like a utility where you open up your faucet and the water comes out. It's like, yeah, you know, I should be able to launch a instance, rent some capacity bandwidth, do my thing, and then tear it down right away. And then now you have to step in and say, no, wait a minute. Like, it doesn't work that in networking. And they don't accept that, right? Like, it's just stupid, like, in their mind.
I can say that one of the always hot discussions that we had in the team at that point, they were very vocal, they were very passionate about networking. They had a very automated network at that point when I joined the team. But I was always pushing to, let's go into continuous deployment. I want to change something on the code, Git approve, code there. And as you can imagine, when you are managing more than 40 data centers in the world that can break in an easy way, that was not so easy. But this experience that you are explaining, because it is something that I have very deep myself, I am coming from that. So as you mentioned, I was not moving from networking engineering into network automation. I moved to a different level of understanding what I want to use as a developer. That explains the reason that I am so strong these days pushing into a topic that I would like to discuss later. That is what I call network as a product or network as a service that connects directly to the design-driven approach to how to build your network automation. We can talk later about that, but I was publishing kind of a small post a few months ago where I was explaining this idea that from networking, we have to start bringing ourselves to the level that we deserve and the people expect from us. People expect to consume our network a self-service approach. So they expect to not talk with network engineers via mail or via ticket.
Via Slack.
They want things up. And this is very challenging because creating these abstractions takes a lot of time.
Right. Why wait, right? Like, let's fast forward to what you really, you know, feel passionate about, because obviously this is on your mind. You've been writing blogs about it. So let's take maybe just 2 minutes to go from, okay, now you join DNS/Cisco, and then fast forward to where you formed this idea. So somewhere in there, you joined NTC, right?
Yeah, exactly. So working for Cisco as a network reliability engineer, mostly like automating the network directly from everything, let's say operations, development. It was a great experience for me to get usage not only to automation, but also to BGP in production at scale. But at some point, as I said, I always move into this exponential learning experience. When I start feeling that there is no exponential anymore, it's like linear. That's a kind of, to me, a signal, a trigger that says, oh, let's start looking for something different.
How do you define that, though? I mean, I find it very hard to, because, you know, you're talking about knowledge. So there's no like numbers, right? Like, you're talking about exponential. So not just to the second power, to the third power. So is it just in your gut that you feel, okay, for the last 2 months?
To me, it's very easy. If you don't feel nervous in front of a challenge, you are not exponentially learning. You are just linearly, incrementally adding. You have to get this feeling similar to when you go in front of a conference, of an audience, and start doing a talk. You always get nervous. Maybe you have done 20, 50 times, doesn't matter. This is that feeling that you are doing something new. Even you get also used to everything. As I said before, I have been contributing to the university teaching for years. But what I have done was I went there, I create a new subject, I teach it for 1-2 years. And when I get, let's say, bored of the topic, I bring someone in just to continue my subject and I start a new one and a new one. So I always have this feeling that I have to tackle something new, something new, something new that brings me something different on the experience. And this is what even I had no experience at all as a consultant in 2020, I got the opportunity to join Network to Code. And Network to Code was a network automation consulting company that is also delivering services and product. But it gives me this experience that I have been able to deliver, I don't know, 50 different projects for different 50 companies with different scale. So this variety of things within the same company, it's a good match for my personality.
I think that's a good point. It's not so much about the company, but more about the position. There are positions within, you know, OpenDNS, Cisco, or Arista, or wherever, NTC, that you could have this exponential growth. And there are other positions where, you know, maybe you're at a stage of your life, you just want kind of a linear growth. I think I've been to both. It's like, I don't always want exponential growth. Sometimes it's nice to just sit around and say, okay, I'm going to focus a little bit more on, you know, I got my master's pretty late. I'm going to focus a little bit more on school, or a little bit more focus on the family, where, you know, I don't sit around twiddling my thumb at work, but I still grow, but it's just not this, you know, quote unquote exponential growth as you described.
And to me, that's totally fair. I mean, you can get this feeling in your day-to-day work and day-to-day job, but also you can do it externally in other side projects. So it doesn't need to be on the same page. And usually, if you are doing the same exponential growth in many places, that's going to lead you to burnout.
You're going to break.
Exactly. So the point is to balance. You also have a family. Your family will have different needs at different stages. Everything has to go into a balanced way. We can talk about that later also, but Network to Code, and when I already was working for Cisco before, even before the COVID, I was working remotely. So For me, working remotely, without working like that, I would not make myself happy enough because I could count with no fingers the companies in Barcelona that work about network automation. I would never be working for network automation in Barcelona at the level that I'm working in Network to Code. So working remotely makes me feel connected to my family, to my origins, at the same time being exposed to a global pool of talent and challenges from different companies.
Right. That's a good point. And I just want to say, I'm not slacking, right? Like, just because I'm looking for linear growth, I'm still okay in Christian's eyes, personal growth wise. So let's go back to what you were talking about, because, okay, now you've joined Network to Code and you're formulating your idea about this network as a service or a design builder. All of these projects are kind of formulated in your mind while working on customer projects. And of course, you know, your own design thinking and your own architecture. So let's walk through a little bit over that, because when you join NTC, you actually went through several different positions, right? You joined as professional services consultant, or take us back to that time and how you're formulate your idea.
Yeah, totally. When I joined Network to Code, I still remember it was pretty clear in my mind that I had a very tough project because it was behind the deadlines.
Mm-hmm. It was like, let's give it to the new guy.
Maybe. Or maybe they had high expectations on my delivery.
Sorry. That's good intention.
But the point is, was I was like a lot of Python people. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of network engineers coming from Python background. So Python was my main language at that point. It still is. But the project was an OpenConfig Go related project. So I had to go up to speed with Go to start delivering that. And it was kind of a delivery of a project into a company, and they were able to take on. And after that, I started doing different projects with Python about network automation. Around at that point, we still were sponsoring NetBox, then we moved into Nautobot. But everything was about solving actual problems for many different companies. But I could say less than 1 year after I joined the company, I had the honor and the opportunity to be the first architect to join the recent creation of that team, the architectural team in Network to Code. Mm-hmm. And I would do a call out to this team because it's a very rare or special thing in the company. You already know Eric on that team, but it's a team that for the audience to understand what's about, it's very close to what in the tech industry represent the staff engineer. So this soft technical leadership that you are not managing anyone directly, so there is no direct managing of people, but you have to take the leadership about where to go on the technical delivery. Even, again, you are not accountable for delivery because there is what we call the managing consultant that has the final responsibility to deliver. But as an architect, we have this responsibility that is, we know about what the industry is doing. We know about our product, what we can do on the product. We know because we work in all the projects in the company today and in the past. We know what we have been delivering. We have all this experience. We sing together. It's not a big team, but we sing together twice per week in order to share this knowledge bidirectionally. So we transfer the knowledge towards the different projects. So we reuse all our experience. But even more important, we learn from the different engagements just to see what makes sense. What makes sense at every point, because as you can imagine, and this is something that Network to Code has been promoting lately, is this network automation maturity assessment, because not everyone is at the same level of maturity in terms of how to adopt automation. Mm-hmm. What I said before, this network as a service or network as a product, that's not something that you can do when you start at all.
Right. Not right out of the gate with CCNA and I don't know, Catalyst Center. But also, you know, I want to do a shout out since we're back into that time machine, right? Do a shout out to Damien Garros, who was the leader of Network Architect team at the time. Now he's, you know, went on to found Opsmill and what's the product, the source of truth?
InfraHub.
InfraHub. Yeah. So it's the product. So, and now it's led by Ken Salenza. And now you've actually grown, you know, back to that exponential growth again. Now you're leading that team as well. So from Network Architect, you grew the team. Now you're leading that team as well. So back to what you were talking about. So throughout this time where you dealing with a bunch of company, you've seen similarities, you've seen things that have deltas where between different companies. Now you're formulating your idea. So I want to bring it back to this kind of thought process that you have at this time. So what are your thoughts about the state of network automation at this stage after everything you've seen and after you kind of seen on both sides?
From my perspective, What I have seen in almost every project that I have been working on or even conversations in conferences is that we are missing common mental model of what's network automation. So if you ask what's network automation to 5 people, you will get 10 answers. I mean, sometimes has even more than one answer. And the point is because it's a very abstract question. So people sometimes map a network automation to a tool that they know, for example, Ansible, very popular in the community, but others could map to some traditional network management systems. People think in automation more in the observability part, others more in the source of truth is getting a lot of engagement because people understand finally that data is the key for automation. Automation is going to be as good as your data is. What I think that we need, and actually I have been joining some of the latest meetings from the Network Automation Forum, that they are trying to promote an architecture or a reference model. To me, that's very important that we can do it right. Why? Because it has to be simple. It doesn't need to be like 10 different blocks. No, maybe if you can do it in 5-4 blocks, that people can just map their ideas into something that others can agree. I mean, not agree on how to implement the solution, but agree that in the net, for example, that's my perspective, but in a network automation framework, you have some building blocks such as the source of truth, where you have consistent view of what you want the network to be. You have what we call the automation engine, that is some automated processes, call it Ansible, Terraform, Python script that transform the data into the actual network state. And there is also another component that to me looks obvious that everyone will agree that is observability. So let's check the actual state in order to know if things are going well or wrong. Then there are other options. And this is to me something that in order to start a successful network automation strategy, notice the difference between a strategy and a project, because it's more like a long-term strategy that includes not only technical things, but cultural people alignment. You need to have a reference and you need to understand what are the goals that you are trying to solve, because these goals, no one better than every company understands. So what is keeping me awake at night in terms of what I have to solve, what is taking most of my time and is not bringing the value that we think that have to be delivering. I mean, to me, this global or common model, it's a very important question to solve and doesn't need to be complex, but people have to share the same understanding just to build something on top.
Yeah, I mean, and I want to do a little plug for NS for Networking. I think it was episode maybe 6 or 7 where they invited Russ White to talk about reference model, right? Like OSI reference model. And in the podcast, they mentioned they've yet to seen, you know, in the combined, I don't know, 40, 50 years that they've worked in the industry, they've yet to seen somebody who aligns perfectly to the OSI model, but we still use the reference model because it gives us a common ground to discuss, you know, layer 3. So we're talking about, okay, addressing, and as Russ put it, the 4 things that it needs to solve, you know, at different layers. So we could actually agreed on kind of this construct, this abstraction level, on what problem is trying to solve so that we're on a common ground for discussion. That's a starting point, as opposed to, as you mentioned, you know, when we talk about automation, then 5 people have 10 different answers. So we need to have some kind of boundary and common ground to stand on in order to progress. But the question I have, Christian, I mean, I agree with that, but the question I have is, yes, we need that, but it's so abstract. I mean, I need to push out a configuration tomorrow, right? Or I need to solve that OS upgrade for next week before, you know, the network blows up. So how do we find the balance between finding the time to discuss about this reference model, which is important, but not immediate, but now that we have these immediate questions and problems that we need to solve, that would just squeeze out all the time we have before we could have any kind of spare cycle to talk about the reference model?
For me, even you have to solve a very small problem, as you said, like something that is urgent to solve, you need still a plan. A plan that maybe doesn't need to take 1 month to elaborate. You can elaborate a plan in 1 hour or in half an hour. If it's a small problem, it's going to be a small plan. But one of the big mistakes in network automation is that as soon as you can, you have to make this initiative not a single person initiative. It has to be shared, at least between 1, 2, 3 people in a way that they can collaborate. Because if there is no collaboration, all these things will end up, because maybe you upgrade it in an automated way, someone wants to do something manual and it's going to be like a conflict. So you have to get into a place where you are collaborating with someone else, even to create the plan. What does it mean? That in order to collaborate, two people have to share a mental model and they have to understand what we need to solve. Maybe we want to automate the OSA grade system. And we know that this is for a subset of routers, that we know where we have the file. We are going to do like 2 steps, that is send the file and just activate it and reboot. Very simple. The point is that if, and to me it's a requirement, if we want to make something that is reproducible, all the reproducibility comes from data. So you have to understand that you will execute what your data says. And sometimes the data is the code itself. So you are hard coding the data in the code. However, this is still data. And if you have an Ansible playbook where you have some data in the playbook or in an external group bars, whatever, this is your source of truth. And you have to be honest with yourself saying, okay, from my perspective, Ansible, the core is an engine that will execute a task. But if I hard code the data is your source of truth. Maybe you don't need to put like a full system like Nautobot to organize your data. You can just put it in group bars and to get started is good enough. However, if you have this mental exercise to understand that the data that you have in that playbook is your source of truth for now, you have already the seed for you to understand that at some point, maybe you will need to move that data into another place because this data is what drives your strategy. To me, is that the point? Start small, but be honest with yourself, understanding that maybe you are mixing everything in one script, and maybe that script at the end has some SNMP pooling to check something. So you are actually implementing observability. You can put everything in a 20 lines script, all the system, and you can do even a user interface. But everything eventually will evolve into systems that will have their own scope.
Okay, so let me unpack that a little bit because there's a lot there. I'll paraphrase and see if I got your point correctly or not. So if I think back to myself, you know, I certainly didn't come up with the OSI model. It was created probably before I was born, but I take it as it is, right? So I believe that some people who have big brains have come up with it and it works well. And, you know, I starting to map that reference model into my daily learning, even solving real problem, but keeping that model in mind. So if I overlay that with what you were talking about is that to just get started, you might not spend as much time designing the model, but you could actually accept the model where it is. And then you could start small on when you're solving that problem, say your OS upgrade or your config backup, that you start mentally separating that this fits into the automation engine, this fits into orchestration engine, and then start small. So I see you're shaking your hand. So let me know if you want to add something.
I want just to make sure that we understand what we are talking about model.
Okay.
Because then we will talk about data models. That is another story. So when I was talking about model, I was talking more about the OC model, that is a reference architecture where you have the different layers, everyone with different functionalities. That's what I think that we need. In Network to Code, actually, when I joined the company, they already had reference architecture. We have, I think, that 6 blocks that we use as the reference. And I'm not saying that our reference is the best or the only one. I have seen others, but most of those just have the same meaning. What I think that will be good is to get into a common understanding. I think that there is benefit for everyone to understand, like in the OC model, you have like different layers. Maybe some of them you don't use, maybe others like the 6, 7, 6, and 5 that you put together. Actually, this week in the NetBCN meeting that we have in Barcelona, I learned about layer 8, 9, and 10 in the OC model.
The politics and money.
Exactly. So that I heard something about that in the past, but I didn't know about that. The point to me is that we need, like any language, some basic rules to make us understand each other.
Yeah, for sure. I think I agree with that. What we're discussing is a reference, you know, very similar to an abstract reference model, as opposed to like a database model, that we need to come up with a common language, right? Common language and agreed upon different, maybe practitioners and vendors, at least in principle, at least in overall. You could still have your own, but at least, you know, overall component wise, we still have those. But I think that's a big topic. We're not going to solve that problem between the two of us in the next 5 minutes.
We can create our own architectural model.
Yeah, exactly. The network automation model. And you better take it or leave it, right? Because it's the bestest. Let's go back. I mean, just during our conversation, right? You mentioned BCN. You mentioned, and I know you're a avid runner, that you typically take some time to take care of your body, take care of your family. So let's talk about that a little bit. How about, you know, we start with what are some of the big activities that you've organized just in the last like 2 years?
Wow, that's a very interesting question.
Do you need to take off your shoes so you could count more than, you know, 10?
No, I mean, how many hours we have to talk about that? But yeah.
Maybe we'll make it 5 episodes, a part 1 of 5.
I can just track. I have a whiteboard on my side that I track the different activities that I lead.
Yes.
One is, as you mentioned, in Barcelona, we organize the NetBCN community. It's a network-related community that we organize since 2016, not alone. Mm-hmm. So I work, for example, with Paolo Lucente, with Marc Sunyer, Camilo Cardona, and others, in order, to be honest, just to satisfy our curiosity. When I have a topic that I want to discuss, I invite people just to come to the city and share this knowledge. And we had really top names, actually, this week, and I'm going to share.
Well, I've never been there, so you don't have all the top... No, just kidding.
No, but it will happen eventually. So, for example, this week, we had an event, and in the panel, maybe I'm going to tell you 3 names that you are familiar. Mm-hmm. Damien Garros from OpsMill, Jason Edelman from Network to Code, and Mark Coleman from Netbox. First time that the 3 founders of these 3 prominent social...
Yeah, I didn't see any blood or anything in the pictures. I assume it was a cordial and...
No. It was a very nice conversation. 2 hours conversation, a panel, 2 hours. And I just put myself completely out of the... I was not asking questions, just to not make it longer. But it was a very funny event. I also had my co-author of the Observability book, David Flores. I mean, we try to bring very top people in this conference, especially people in Europe. For example, we had David Barroso some years ago. Mm-hmm. And I will forget people for sure, but last year was Roman from Container Lab. Mm-hmm. Many people that we just invite, and Javier Antique that is working on AI. I mean, many people, and we keep doing that every now and then, so every semester. Mm-hmm. Aside, as I mentioned, I'm collaborating with the university, just doing some special network automation courses from every year, more or less. I have been writing books for a while. Mm-hmm. And now I'm in my 4th one that hopefully is going to be delivered in a few months about Ansible, this one. I'm collaborating with different initiatives, community, just to share coding knowledge with young people or just to promote other open source projects such as PMACCT, that is a flow collector. This is more on technical stuff, just to fulfill my curiosity.
Right.
In my personal side, my main passion is trail running, so running in the mountains. Mm-hmm. And I have like 2 different questions here. I mean, I have been running many marathons on the last year. I started running 15 years ago. So I ran around 3,000 kilometers per year with a very different complex, let's say, tracks. But in this scope, something that makes me, let's say, very proud is that since 2015, together with my brother, we start organizing a trail race in my hometown. So its name, if you want to check it, Cursa de la Airosa. And the next edition, that is going to be the 9th, is happening in at the end of April this year. So yeah, it's a very challenging activity because we bring more than 300 runners. And in my hometown, it's just 500 inhabitants. So it's a very small one. And I have to, as a director of the race, I have to organize more than 250 volunteers just to make it happen.
So describe the race a little bit. You say running in the mud, right? So is the race like, you know, I don't know, 26 miles? What's the elevation? What's the path like? What kind of permits do you need to get from the government?
The race that I organize, it's 21 kilometers. I don't know the conversion to miles.
Yeah, no worries.
It's like a half marathon.
About 13 miles.
And you just get a final elevation positive of 1,500 meters.
Mm.
So just to take an idea, the top runners, the best ones in the region, they end their race around 2 hours and 15 minutes. So it's not super fast race.
Mm-hmm.
The average is around 3 hours and a half, something like that.
That's pretty difficult because anyways, I mean, I'm not a runner, but I have my own, you know, kind of thoughts on that. Yeah. So how do you find the time to do all these activities? I mean, I'm kind of exhausted just hearing all the activities that you're organizing. So how do you balance that between work and the exponential growth that you're talking about?
To me, that's totally connected with the idea of make my agenda, my schedule myself. So I am the owner of my schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not very proud of, but I have a very complex work agenda. So you have access to it and you can see that it's not easy for me to find a slot to, because I have a lot of meetings because of this nature of my job. I work with different customers. I have to be part of many different internal initiatives.
Right.
I have to coordinate many different things in Network to Code and in different countries, different time zones, because I have customers in Europe, customers in the US, West Coast, East Coast. So it's a very complex setup. How I make it happen? So the other question is that you have to know yourself and be honest. I'm an early morning person. So I usually, without any clock alarm, I start working, start at 5 in the morning every day. Do I have to go hands-on on keyboard? And no, what I usually do on the first half an hour, I organize my day. Then if I was able to start at the right time and I have capacity, I just maybe spend half hour moving forward different initiatives. For example, my books that I also do on the weekends. And then I start working on my first big chunk of the morning. So from 6 to 8 is kind of doing the first important focus work because I know myself and I'm the most productive at this moment. At that point, there are no people, no customers, if I don't have anyone in Australia, that happens from time to time.
Those Australians.
What I go is I go running for 2 hours. This is my average, let's say 1 hour and a half. I go 6 days per week for run. So this makes me move into mid-morning around 10. I still have 2-3 hours. This time is more for syncing with architects in Europe and customers in Europe. Then I move into lunch. And lunch, to me, it's a very important, and you will say this is a very typical stereotype of Spanish people.
5-hour lunches. And
I take a siesta, a nap. Not a long one, maybe half an hour, maybe 45 minutes, but it's crucial because what happens to me is that when I wake up, like when I just start my afternoon at 2, I usually have one meeting of 5 hours, just half an hour after half. I have like a full afternoon full of meetings. If I was not able to do this connection and get this recharge of my energy, I will not be productive because then I have to adapt to these different companies that maybe are in the West Coast and I have to work until a bit late. I try to limit myself. So to be honest, I want to be with my family as much as I can. I am able to have breakfast with them. I am able to have lunch with them, dinner with them, but I try to cut my day around 6:30.
Yeah, I think that's interesting point that you made on just knowing yourself. I myself, I'm very protective of my time as well. But one of the toughest things that, you know, especially when I first joined NTC, where I have to get on these customer calls like you have, is that I don't control those times. You know, like the customers would be, we just have this 30 minutes and we have to take it. So that becomes pretty fragmented. And for me, you know, I don't think I know myself as well as you do. So a lot of times I feel if I don't do the things I need to do in the morning, then the whole day is wasted on just meetings after meetings and so on. So I could probably learn many things from you on just kind of time management, fragment it out, knowing yourself, and tackle the hardest thing first. So I like that very much.
Yeah, I have been not only documenting myself as, again, learning on that area, but because I also very interested on different other topics that I have been developing on my life. But this is something that I prove myself very good at organizing. Actually, Ken Salenza, that has been my manager, aside from Damien, for a small period of time in Network to Code. Mm-hmm. I have always been working with Ken. Can always tell me that, yeah, I'm very good at organizing my time.
He actually told me to. I mean, I think the first meeting we've had after I joined Otico was for me asking you how you organize your time. Upon Ken's recommendation, is just, you know, go talk to Christian, because he's able to take like 5 time zone calls and still live and breathe to the next day. So let's talk about that. So Christian, I mean, we cover a bunch of topics from your background to how you get into network automation, to your vision on, you know, the current state of network automation and what keeps you up at night. So I want to do forward looking a little bit on both. What do you think the future holds? Let's start with the industry. Then let's move on to what do you think the future holds for yourself? So let's start with where do you think the future holds for network automation? What is the next wave, I think?
Well, to me, we have not still talked about one of my main passions, that is design-driven or self-healing networks, and all this idea to make networking consumable mm-hmm. by our users. So I understand the limitations. As you said, we have to get started with something that works and we get the network engineers on board. Mm-hmm. But to me, the goal here is to reach a point where these people that get into the concept of network automation can transfer that network into something that they don't directly operate. They drive, they manage, they architect the network in a way that is reproducible. So, for example, and this connects with this idea that I have been promoting a lot in conferences lately about design-driven. And to be honest, it's not a specific of one tool. We have a very capable implementation in Autobot, but I have seen people from InfraHub, from Netbox, praising about that idea. I mean, it's something that is common for the industry. And to me, it's something that we have to adopt. What I mean is that we agree that we need data to drive our network automation strategy. This data has to be consistent, has to put some validation in place about the logic that makes sense. However, we are still used to micromanage that data. So I think network engineers still think that they have to go into maybe into a form, into a UI, or into a YAML in JIT. It doesn't matter. And go and change a lot of things every time in order to make that data available for the network automation tools to do their job. Mm-hmm. To me, that's maybe something that, like, a first step. But what we have to reach is a point where this data ingestion that defines the state of your network is completely abstracted in the right level to your users of the network. That maybe initially are network engineers that are driving the network, but at the end, we want these network services, the same way that I said before, when I was working as a DevOps engineer, I want to use the network as a service. I want to provision a circuit. I want to provision a firewall rule. I don't expect to call anyone or just do a change on a place and wait for someone to approve my data change to go into the network. My vision is that the network architects, the one that have been making their life creating diagrams in Visio, Dry.io, just for how the network should look like, that's, from my perspective, is not useful as it should be. What they have to be doing is coding their vision of how the data will be transformed from a small into long set of real data that goes into the source of truth in order to drive the automation. For example, very common example, but I can give you different ideas. We are in a company, for example, that want to deploy many branches. And every branch, depending on their different sizes, there are small, medium, and big. And just to keep it simple, in the small branch, we deploy 3 access points, in the big one, 8, and in the extra large, 50 access points. Every access point will need cabling to the switch, to connect to a router, an IP address, just to make all this information. Do we have to ask the network engineer to provide this information? Not at all. Why? Because the network architect only has to ask the network engineer from the locations that are available, that maybe has been synchronized from someplace, Workday, ServiceNow, whatever. From these locations that are available in your system, select one that is not already deployed. You are doing something new. Actually, you can filter these things. You show the available locations to deploy, and you just ask for the size. Then from this minimum input, keep life easier to your users. and reduce the potential errors that they can produce to your data. With this information, your design should be able to expand to make all the decisions that have to be taken. What's the next available prefix? Which vendor I have to choose? Maybe if I am building a branch in China, I will get Huawei. And if I'm building the site in US, I will get another one. So all these decisions should not be taken by your user. Your architect has all these things in the code, validation. There is no need for approval of the data going into the automation because the actual approval happens in the design phase. When the architect is creating the design that expands the data, there is where the actual approval process of how this data is created has to happen. To me, it's a very transformational idea. I know that this is something that you cannot, let's say, target at the beginning of your journey, but this is where we should go. Because people, actually, we cannot expect that people will be happy creating a ticket, waiting for an approval. That's not how cloud native people work.
Yeah, that's true. I could already see that this would be a multi-stage process because even the idea of more declarative versus procedural where you say, hey, you know, I want a VLAN yes or no versus, you know, go config T interface and VLAN 300, whatever, right? So procedural versus declarative, that idea still needs to be planted, let alone, you know, having this designed reference.
Yeah. And to me, this is not the end of the story, because when you start working with this design-driven approach, you are not only thinking on the creation of things. Imagine that instead of just creating a new branch, a new data center, your design is creating, I'm going to say, because I don't know the high level, but an ACL. Imagine that you're creating a firewall rule that enables in a conference, like this week, you have a conference and you want to enable like all your guests to reach some specific portal for some reason.
Right.
All these instructions, what I have to ask the user is, okay, tell me the portal and all the details, all the firewalls, all the things that have to be updated, all this data. Again, I'm not talking about the design changing the network. I'm just the design changing the data that drives the network. So all these decisions can be taken, can be created. And important, all this data for this design or the other one can follow a complete life cycle. What does it mean a life cycle? That when the conference is over, I would like to go there and set the commission that service and all the ACLs that have been created in 20 firewalls in one shot in an atomic transaction, everything disappears from the data. So eventually, if the data goes away, the network will converge to that state. But not only the commissioning, maybe updating. What I mean is that you create something like, for example, you create a data center that you created with a size S. And at that moment, size S meant 3 access points. But later on, your architect decides that no, a small size, because it has to be for quality, 5 access points. What does it mean is that if the design wants to move from the old version of the design to the new one, the data will be moved from 3 access points to 5 access points. We are not going to remove the 3 old access points. You are just going to create 2 new access points. So you have to understand what's the difference and move into that. And when you approach this way, where all the objects of a design are tracked together, you can then enforce something like the design protection. So you can make sure that whatever your design is changing, no one else can change. For example, if on my data center design, on these firewall routers, I put 4 ACLs that are kind of the foundational ones, I cannot expect anyone going to the data and changing that ACL. That's breaking the contract of the design. For sure, you can add some new ACLs if that's not in the contract of the design. But we have to make clear that design-driven is not only creating, it's also updating, decommissioning, and enforcing the standards.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that would be a great goal to shoot for. As you mentioned, you know, I want to enable this protocol with this ACL. I don't really care where that placement ACL or even the port number. Those are already driven. Those are already built into the instruction. And I just have to say, I want this from this day to this day and automatically gets taken off afterwards. So Christian, we're kind of running on time. So I want to combine the last two questions, right? So previously I've asked what's the future hope for Christian. And I wanted to also combine that with, if fear is no option, if fear is not a choice, right? No fear. What would you do next?
Now, to me, I'm always open to different types of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
However, something that I realized because I have been experimenting on different areas is that what I feel more comfortable these days as I'm getting older is For sure. I still want to combine the network domain with the software development. However, there are plenty of different scope here. You can do from what I'm doing now, that is network automation, but I'm always, let's say, open to, and I am learning like more low-level network programmability with eBPF or more Linux control plane, how these things work at this level,
right,
or creating, as I said before, abstractions on how create network services. So this is everything that I see in my future is always connected to this area. Bringing together network experience, but again, I would not consider anymore myself a capable network engineer. I see myself more a software developer. And to be clear, I'm also not a software developer that can go to an interview and create an algorithm, because that's not what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. What I have been doing for the last maybe 10 years is creating, failing, learning about how to create systems, how to bring things together in a way that I can already anticipate when something has to grow, has to scale, has to be put in production, which will be the challenges that you will face, and try to implement solutions in order to mitigate them. So bringing these things together, to me, it's networking, software development at system level. And because I have been doing this for the last 3 years, I see myself on the leadership positions, software leadership positions. So these soft staff engineering positions, where I have realized myself that I have been able to do bigger impact in my surroundings if I am able to collaborate with others directly. So enabling others have brought me more capacity to do bigger things than doing on my own. I can do on my own. I can work, let's say, 15 hours per day, but I will never deliver as much as I can today just enabling others to collaborate with me.
Yeah, I like those adjacent possibilities. Obviously, all the big areas that you mentioned, and even the overlap between those three circles is big enough that the world is your oyster. So Christian, as we come to the end of the recording, where can people find you? Where can people follow your work if they want to learn more?
Yeah, I mean, you can find me many places.
As we have mentioned, even on trail running, right?
Exactly. If you're interested in, I used to run every month in some competitions here in my region. But yeah, if you want to talk about network automation, you can reach me. Maybe the main channel is going to be LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. You can find me at christian.aday.linkedin.
Yeah, we'll have those in the show notes.
Yeah, and aside of that, you can reach me asynchronously also in the Slack channel of the Network to Code, Network Automation Forum. I have been writing books, so if you have any question, you can also connect me by that. And if you go to some Network Automation conference, there are some, let's say, odds that I will be around.
At least in spirit.
And if you come to Barcelona to the NetBCN meetup that we are organizing here, and now I say for more than 9 years, more than 40 events that we have organized, you will find me for sure here. Not presenting, because I have never presented in this event, aside of maybe one or two times when I was talking about things completely different from network automation. I remember presenting about an eBPF pet project that I did. But yeah, you will be able to find me in many places. And I'm more than happy to collaborate with people and also in different open source projects. I mean, I have been collaborating to dozens of them, and I'm looking for more to participate on.
Nice. So just to confirm, I've seen the videos, so the BCNs are recorded, right? And they're posted on YouTube.
A few of them, because we don't have any, let's say, it's completely non-profitable organization. We don't have anything to organize in a, we had some sponsors to help us with some logistics, but we depend always on the venue. If the venue has a recording thing, we record the event. The last one from March, this week, is going to be available in the next days.
I think that's the one I saw. Maybe just somebody with the iPhone.
Maybe.
So, you know, thanks again for making the time on the show. You know, we'll come back. And I imagine, you know, in the future, we'll probably invite you a couple more times, maybe when the Ansible comes out. Will you be able to make some time for us?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Always.
Thanks again for being here, man. And thank you, listeners, for listening to this episode of Network Automation Nerds. Do you have any feedbacks for Network Automation, our guest Christian today, or this episode in general? Please send us some follow-ups at packetpushers.net/follow-up. We do very much want to hear from you. And please check our website at packetpushers.net to find other network engineering-focused podcasts. You can find podcasts such as Network Break for weekly shows, Heavy Networking for deep dives, Packet Protector for security, and so much more. Also on the site, you can also find other blogs, YouTube videos, links to our merch store, and so much more. We thank you, the wonderful listeners, for your support. Last but not least, remember that too much network automation will never be enough.